Good evening, everybody. Thank you for your presence in our meeting tonight. We appreciate very much those of you who have been at work to help us enjoy the accomplishments of several young people whom we think highly of, and to be with their families as well. We appreciate those of you who have been here early for our blessing group meeting. Thank you for your faithful and selfless and dependable service of trying to encourage people. Kay and I have gotten a stack of cards like that over the last few weeks, and we marvel at the thoughtfulness of people, and thank you for it. We want to mention to you that we have a new sister in Christ today. After our service this morning, Tina and John Oram's daughter, Jessica, came to tell us that she had been thinking about this and that she wanted to obey the gospel before this day was over. And so we celebrate with the Oram family. She's back there trying to wave at me like that. So we are so thankful for that today. I want to say some things to our graduates tonight because I love them. And I want to say them in church because they are just as important for all the rest of us. And I hope you'll take them that way. If you young men and women remain who we all think you are, and if you do with your lives what all of us think you will, you are going to be a blessing to the world. And I'm glad to be able to say that and to mean it. I do mean it. I wish that my generation were handing off to you guys a world which was everything you could ever hope that it might be. I've thought some about this over the last couple of weeks and working on this. We're passing along to you a world where campuses are free from protests over the Vietnam War, but also campuses which have shootings on them now and protest over all kinds of other things. We are passing along to you a world where we've taken away all inhibitions, and now you can do anything and no one gives a second thought to it. But we're not passing along to you a world where people can be ashamed of what they ought to be ashamed of. We're passing along to you a world where we have, as a society, have spent a whole lot of money to wipe out poverty. But we're not passing along to you a lower poverty rate, nor are we passing along to you a world where there is family structure enough to support well-being. We're passing along a world to you where we have gone from party line phones where your neighbors could listen in to now constant time on the phone where everybody can see what you had for lunch, and where people are unable to put it down, look each other in the eye, and relate to one another. We're passing along a world which has all kinds of regulations about taking care of things around us, but where there is not a lot of confidence about whether things around us will be there to support us for that long into the future. We're passing along a world to you with a lot more prosperity and gadgets but with less hope. And when I think about what is ahead for you and what kind of responsibility my generation bears for a whole lot of that, I wish it were better. But that brings us to what the passage, our question for tonight, says to us, and the value of this for each one of you. Maybe you are an answer to this question. From Esther chapter 4, the last part of verse 14, and who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Maybe you guys are the ones the Lord knew would be needed for such a time as this is. In order to appreciate the question that was posed in this verse from Esther, there's some background information that's needed. You need to know about two peoples and five persons. The two peoples are the Persians and the Jews. The Persians hold sway at the time when this question is asked for, over all of the territory from what is now India to what is now Ethiopia. And all of the nations that you can name right now that are always in the evening news were a part of the territory dominated by the Persians. They were the power of the world at the time. And the Jews were a people whose country had been overrun and whose capital had been destroyed and whose God had been disgraced, and who had been scattered among first the Babylonians and then the Persians. And these people had been looked down upon because they had laws that other people didn't have, and they had customs that other people didn't respect. And they worshiped a God who did not allow for the gods of the other nations. And these hopeless, downtrodden people are living as captives in exile in a land with a million times more power than they could imagine for themselves. And into this background, the five people who are players in this drama appear. The first one is Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is the king of Persia, the Persians and the Medes at the time. He is a king who is, when this book begins, seeking to put his own glory on display. He needed to because he had only been king for 3 years, and it was dangerous at that time. Ahasuerus is better known by his Greek name of Xerxes I. And he's a fellow who, from secular history, is known as a guy who led some 2 million soldiers into battle over other parts of the world and brought 500 of them home. Can you see why he might have needed to show his glory and might have needed to impress people with his power? He was king in Persia from 486 to 465 B.C. And in biblical terms, this is after the exiles who returned to captivity, after the first group went, but before the last group in Ezra and Nehemiah's time got there. So that's sort of the time period. When this book opens, this guy who is surrounded by splendor, white and scarlet hangings and marble columns and mosaic floors and silver and gold couches and a feast that goes on. He's had everything on display for 180 days, and then he invites everybody in town to the great feast that went on for 7 days. The second person that you need to know is his queen, Vashti. Vashti was throwing a celebration for the women of the empire at the same time the other celebrating was going on, when the drunken king sent for her to also be put on display before his guests. She was beautiful. And whether her being shown just meant her making appearance, or whether it meant something worse, I don't know. But I can see that it meant something, because she refused to come. She was unwilling to be put on display before a drunken party. And a king who wanted to impress the country with his power could not allow for a queen who wouldn't do what he said. So the decree is made that she be excluded from her royal duties, and that she never appear before the king ever again, and that someone else be found, someone young and beautiful be found to be made queen of the empire. The third character in the story is old Haman. Haman is the king's counselor, the highest of all his advisors in the land, and a man who had an ego to go with the heights to which he had risen. He was a fellow, the kind of fellow, who could not enjoy anything good as long as one person did not think he was the hottest fellow around. He was the kind of a man who could carry a grudge against one man to the point that he'd want to destroy everybody else of that man's nationality. He was the kind of a fella who, when anything good was proposed to happen, just naturally assumed that he would be the recipient of it, or at least that he should be. Not a very enjoyable kind of a guy, but maybe a too common kind. The fourth character is Mordecai. Mordecai is a Jewish man who, living in that captivity, had brought up his cousin as his own daughter. The young cousin's father was Mordecai's uncle, and her father and mother had died long since, apparently, while she was very young. She listened to Mordecai as if he had been her father. Mordecai, though he was a Jew, sat at the king's gate, at least in my opinion, as something of a gatekeeper, or someone in a place of some responsibility or some honor. And at his advice, Esther did or did not make her nationality known to others who were around, according to the danger of the time. She is the fifth character in this whole story, Esther. Hadassah, her Jewish name. Myrtle, the myrtle plant, as her English name. She's a Jewish maiden who is beautiful and lovely and honorable, who did not seek it out, but who was chosen by the Persian king as the new queen of the empire. She did not allow him to know her nationality at her uncle Mordecai's command. And she rose to the place of influence in the palace, such that everyone that crossed paths with her was impressed with her, and they loved her, and they respected her. Now, in that setting, with these people, something happens that forms the plot in our story. As time goes along, two of the king's chamberlains grow angry with him and begin to plot to have him assassinated or to do him harm. But Mordecai hears their planning and sends word to Esther in the palace about the danger. And she, in Mordecai's name, warns the king, and he is saved alive because of that. And he intends to do something to reward Mordecai for it, but forgets. A little time goes along, and Haman is progressing higher and higher in the empire. But there is one rub. The one rub is that Mordecai the Jew will not stand up and bow his head when Haman passes by like everyone else does. And Mordecai, when asked, explains why he won't do it. It's not out of any ill will to Haman, it's out of respect for God. Mordecai does not bow and worship anybody the way that would be due to the God of heaven. But Haman grows so angry about this that he hatches a plot in which he tells the king, there's a people in the empire that doesn't respect your laws, doesn't intend to be a part of your people, and is a threat, a dangerous one. I propose that you write a letter and put the signet ring on it and let me send it to the land that on the 13th day of the 12th month, we kill them all and put the money into the king's treasury. The king gives him permission to do as he says. Mordecai hears about it and goes into mourning immediately, in agony over what was intended. And he gets word to Esther that she is uniquely in a position to do something about this and to stop this plot. Esther sends word back that the current law is that anybody, no matter who he is or she is, who has the nerve to approach the presence of the king without him asking, is subject to immediate death. And Mordecai sends word back to her that's in the text here, and I'd start reading at verse 13. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's household will perish. And our question, and who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Now, what does all of that have to do with someone who'd be graduating from school or college right now? It's this. The cause of the Lord has just as many threats now as it did then. And it needs people who live for it and speak for it and serve it and its interests. And you might be that person. The New Testament does teach that in the providence of God, God works within His people who obey Him, Philippians 2 and verse 13. It teaches that God is with His people enough that He won't allow us to be tempted above what we're able to bear, but will with the temptation make also a way of escape. It's 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13. It teaches that God is with his people to the point that he works all things together for good to them that love him and are called according to his purpose. What this passage teaches is what is due of one of the Lord's people in allowing this to happen in his or her life. So I want to say to you guys tonight that in practicing this principle, there are four truths from our passage that maybe we all need to be aware of. First, from Esther chapter 4 here, we'd observe that if you are present for such a time as this in God's providence, it will involve your thinking with humility about it and about the work of God in circumstances where it is not readily apparent. In this passage, you notice that even Mordecai says to Esther, "Who knows whether you've not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" The great things in the providence of God are not done by people who say, "The Lord wants me to do this," or "The Lord said, the Lord is doing this right here." There's more humility at work in this passage. Because, you see, it doesn't immediately look to Mordecai or Esther like God has been involved in all of this. God didn't cause Ahasuerus to throw his party. God didn't cause Vashti to do what she did. As far as we can tell, she didn't even believe in it. God didn't cause Haman to be filled with pride to the point of hating Mordecai and all his countrymen. God didn't cause Ahasuerus to seek out some young maiden to be his new queen, and God didn't cause him to sign the letter that decreed the destruction of all the Jews. But in all of that, God had somebody in a position who could say or do something about it. And you and I will have to be people, if we are for such a time as this, who believe that God watches out for his people enough that we are willing to do what we can. Secondly, if you are one for such a time as this, it will involve your identifying with the people of God and with his concern for their best interests and not just for yours. I've noticed that ordinarily we think of the providence of God both in what God allows and what God overcomes. We think of it almost entirely only in individual personal terms. Have you noticed that? When I think of what God's will is or what kind of work he does, I'm interested in my own life, what doors he opens for me and what doors he closes and so forth. But in this passage, Mordecai is reminding Esther, don't think that you can be off by yourself from what happens to the other Jews. Don't think that God won't deliver the Jews in some other way. But do think you might be the one that he can use. Mordecai doesn't even mention God But he has all confidence that the people are going to be delivered in some way. Where would that confidence have come from? It had to be because of God's covenant with his people. I'm encouraging, or trying to encourage you young men and women and all of us to put ourselves within the picture with God's family. And to think in terms of what God allows or doesn't allow, what he addresses or doesn't address right now, to think of the good it will do to all his people, or to the harm that it might do to his cause. And when we think in the broader picture, then we're getting in a position to be the one for such a time as this. Third, if you are here for such a time as this, it will involve your benefiting from the experience of someone around you who is already, and already has been, living with wisdom and honor. I wish I knew how much older than Esther Mordecai was. We're told twice in the first four chapters that she obeyed him still as her father. She was learning, benefiting from him, and from his interest in the cause of the Lord, and from his understanding of life and how life works. When you think about yourself, who is the person, who are the people around you who are sources of that kind of thing in your own life? Who strengthens your sense of honor? Whose experience do you depend on? That kind of need will not change simply because you make a transition from one stage to another. I'm trying to encourage you in a world where we want to look at, hopefully, people who have the same problems we have and are not dealing with them as well, to be the ones that we learn how to live from. Why not look at people who've shown that they know how to live and are have some positive experience at life in that way? And then fourth, if you've been brought to the kingdom for such a time as this, it will involve your turning from merely spotting the problems to actually doing what you're in a position to do, and doing it with faith and initiative and courage. Right before the passage I read, Esther is sending new clothing out to Mordecai because he tore his old ones in his grief. And she's telling him the problem and trying to go in to meet the king. But right after this, she says, "Have everybody pray for me for 3 days. Then she dresses up and goes and stands right out in front of the door of the king's throne room. And when he sees her, she walks in and he asks her what she wants, and she invites him and Haman to a banquet. Then she does that again the next day, and then she tells what's about to be done to her people, and she tells who her people are. And the king says, 'Who would do such a thing?' And she says, 'This wicked Haman.' Nobody else could have said that but her. There have been some things that have happened in my life that have only happened because the right people were there at the right time to encourage me. I don't know if God put them there, but he could have. And their influence means just as much to me as if I knew he had. And in this world where we're to the place where the big questions in people's lives are, what's my purpose in even being here? How am I going to find the best way to live? What makes you think that's any more true than what anybody else thinks? There are going to be some challenges that only faithful Christians are going to be in a position to help with. Maybe that'll be you. I hope it will be. A lot of you guys have already been an encouragement to us. So we thank you and we encourage you to live your life for the Lord as He meant for you to live it, as He means for you to. If you're someone who has not made the good confession and been baptized into Christ, we ask you to not let the changes in your life pass without asking questions about important things like this. And if you're someone who made that beginning and then life has kind of gotten the best of you and you need help, then maybe your family and the Lord praying with you about that would be the right place to find that help. If we can, then would you let us know it by coming here to the front while we stand and sing.